The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this September 19th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. If you haven't already, I really encourage you to follow us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You will get notifications when we podcast new shows. Our past shows are up there. And if you're so inclined and want to help us out, we would love, if you are a regular listener, for you to leave us a little review of the show up there. That will just help us raise our profile. There aren't very many shows like ours out there that provide MFA online little MFA snippets from amazing authors. There's a lot of book shows out there. There are very few shows out there like ours. So you can help us out by doing that. You can follow us on Facebook. We're under Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. You can follow us. You can follow KUCI in general. We got a lot of great programming here. Barbara's website, penonfire.com, mindmariestone.com. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. We've started doing something a little new recently, which is to bring on authors who don't necessarily have a new release, but whom we have nonetheless loved and admired over the years, and for whatever reason we missed having them on in the past. As I said, one of the purposes of this show is to, bring listeners access to writers' minds and writers' methods, give you sort of a little mini MFA lecture on your device. So I called up Joanne Beard. I begged her to come on. Here she is for the full hour. Incidentally, I did the same thing with Rick Moody next month. So actually, in the course of that conversation, I learned he does have a new book coming out next year. So maybe we'll bring him on twice. I don't know. But this hour, we are going to spend the whole hour talking to Joanne about her essays, her novel, what it means to be a writer, writing and craft, all that stuff. Joanne Beard is the author of the essay collection, The Boys of My Youth, and the novel In Zanesville. Boys of My Youth came out in 1998, In Zanesville in 2011. They are both published by Back Bay Books, a division of Little Brown. Joanne's work has appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Best American Essays. She has received a winning award and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation. She teaches nonfiction writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. So when we talked, you put me on to Sandra Gale Lambert, who was on the show a few weeks back, also with a memoir in essay collection that was absolutely wonderful. Are there other writers out there who are particularly wonderful at playing with this genre, this sort of essay memoir genre?
I think there are. And, of course, because I'm on the radio and because you're asking me that, I will not be able to come up with any other name except for Sandra Gale Lambert. But, yes, there are.
It's such a great... I think it's A, it's a great form, and B, for writers who are just starting out, who maybe feel a little bit daunted by the idea of a, 250-page narrative of their life, it's a nice way, I think, to give writers access to their own stories in, sort of bite-sized chunks, and it's really nice for the reader. I haven't read a ton of these, but I'm just in love with that form now.
Right. And why do you think it's nice for the reader?
Because my experience, especially, with the two that I've now just read, is that, I'm also a lover of the short story form. So what it does for you is gives you this very compressed, microscopic look at one aspect of their life rather than getting kind of mired down in, a long narrative that... I don't know. I'm just a bigger lover of the short story form than I am of the novel form. So it's
right. I love the short story form, too. And especially in Sandra's book, the interesting thing for me was that I read that book as a narrative. I read it over one long weekend, and it didn't occur to me that it was a collection of essays. I only understood that after I was out from under the spell of the book itself. And then excuse me, I have a little bit of seasonal allergies today. As soon as I went back to page through it and try to figure out how she had done what she had done, which was, you know, basically robbed me of a weekend of my life, then I started to realize, and also through communications with her, that she hadn't sat down and intended to write one long narrative with a kind of arc in the middle, and a beginning and a middle and an end. But for me, for some reason, I was able to read it that way. I mean, I guess not for some reason, but for the profound reason that she's a really good writer. And she created with that book a world that felt so palpable to me and so clear visually, and I guess, you know, emotionally to me, that as a reader, I was willing to jump from spot to spot, landmark to landmark with her as her thoughts moved through the story. Mm-hmm, so that's why as a reader, I read that not as a collection of essays, but as one long narrative, I think.
Mm-hmm. It also
but
gives...
Should I go ahead?
Yeah, go.
But I also wanted to say that I think that that kind of work is popular now, that kind of work where people write in little bite-sized chunks, which I find myself doing as well. Maybe I've always done that a little bit, but I think I do it more now. And I think it's because, for the obvious reason, that everybody's attention span is fractured. And it doesn't mean that we don't read one gripping book over a whole weekend, but it might mean that while we're reading that book, we need to take it in smaller doses because our brains are being rewired for a kind of short-term memory things as opposed to long-term memory things.
We were just having that conversation at a writer's salon last night, and the difficulty it is for writers to sustain their attention on their task and for readers to sustain their attention on what they're focused on. And that's a whole nother radio show, I guess, about.
I guess it is, but I will just say that I do think that it's a tremendous problem, not just for writers, but for people in general, and not everybody identifies it as a problem. And and maybe this is just my dark take on everything, but even as I got ready to do this interview, I sat down in my chair, I got my cup of tea, and I thought, I need something else. Like, I knew better than to put my computer on my lap, because if I do that, I'll be playing solitaire. And I knew better than to have various other things around me, because I would be distracted by them. But it took a moment for me to actually say to myself, no, you have to sit in a chair for an hour and look out your window and sip your cup of tea and listen carefully to a person and then answer carefully. And I'm embarrassed to say that, but I did have to, like, have that moment with myself. And I think that has something to do with what we're talking about right now, distraction, not just for writers with their own work, but for all of us with our interior lives of silence and solitude and imagination and ideas and just in general thoughts.
There's been this return to the typewriter recently. I have some friends who have become very obsessed with the typewriter, and it's one way of taking your computer completely out of your office and getting back to that tangible, slow, deliberate way that you have to work on a typewriter, and it's very physical. And, you know, maybe that's the antidote to some of this. I don't know, but... I think we're all in the same boat, and the news certainly isn't helping this, but that's also another radio show.
I think so. The news is feels almost as compelling as anything else that could be going on in our heads. So that's not helping. But I will just add that I just watched a documentary the other night about the typewriter, and I felt such a sense of longing for my own past when a typewriter was such a huge part of it, because I learned to type in high school, and I left high school and became a secretary and was a secretary for many, many years before computers were used in offices. So I love the typewriter. I absolutely love it. I love the sound it makes. I love the way it looks. I love the whole idea that you can peer inside it and see the letters in backwards forms on those metal sticks. I recommend that documentary to anybody who wants to see it. I think it's called California Typewriter.
I think that's what set off the little obsession that a group of friends of mine have, is that it's Tom Hanks is in that, right? I think that's
right.
Yeah, that movie has set off a frenzy over here of people starting to collect typewriters, so it's great. You actually, I had read another interview where you were talking about the importance of documentaries as a way for perhaps essayists, other writers, to study the form, the breaking of chronology in the essay form. And I had never thought of that before, but I think that's great advice for writers to take some time and view some of these documentaries as A, for their content, but B, for their structure and a way of reimagining and rethinking the way to tell a story in an essay, that documentaries can be pretty instructive. And I was wondering if you had a couple of favorites that you could recommend to writers that you think might be particularly useful.
Well, I teach documentaries in my nonfiction class for two reasons. One is the one that you just described, which is the reason that I concocted to justify showing them to nonfiction classes, and I've pretty much honed that argument pretty well. But the other reason is that I simply love documentaries. I love the nonfiction form, whether it comes in a memoir, essay, or a documentary. So I sometimes just fall in love with films for one particular tiny reason, and then because I tend to love my students, I want them to share that with me. And so that's why I've concocted that reason why people should watch documentaries. But nevertheless, it is a good reason, because it does help you understand, especially for beginning writers who almost always begin by writing their own story. And when they begin by writing their own story, it makes sense to start at the beginning and write a kind of linear chronology up to the moment where they are now. And of course, it's interesting for the writer, but it's not particularly interesting for the reader, unless that chronology, that linear style, actually reflects something about the story under the surface, and typically it doesn't. So if you watch a documentary and you actually think before you watch it, okay, somebody had to write this. How did they write it? And then you watch how the film moves from one idea to another, you really get a sense of how difficult that form is.
I think that's another advantage of writing these memoir and essays, is because it breaks you out of that chronology, and it, you know, it allows you to organize things thematically rather than chronologically, which tends to make more sense, I think, to art as opposed to fact.
Right.
The fact of
something. And I'll just name, I have a whole stable of documentaries that I like to show, but one of them is always super important, and it's when in my class, undergraduate class, we begin to talk about the process of revision, which is super difficult for me. I rarely do it because I'm not good at it, and it's a skill in its own, and I've never really been able to hone that skill. But I try to teach it because I think it's really an important thing to have. But also, I think we're all kind of resistant to revision because it's hard and because it's not necessarily, doesn't necessarily give you the same psychic boost or excitement that generating new work does. And so one of the films that I show is called Comedian, and it's a documentary about Jerry Seinfeld. And it's really a documentary that's about the process of revision and the difficulty of revision, the commitment that you have to revision, and also sometimes what happens when you don't have that commitment to revision or that commitment to the actual art of what you're doing. And if you haven't seen it, it's really worth it to watch it just for that. It's also funny and rueful, but it shows you how difficult it is to write and how difficult it is to revise your writing. And comedians do it in a completely different way. They do their work by creating it 1 minute at a time, and then they build on those minutes until they finally have whatever they need, 30 minutes or 60 minutes of material that works. But they begin small with 1 minute or 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and then they build on that. And, of course, their audience is right in front of their faces, so they have a slightly different process of getting feedback, but nevertheless, their need to revise is every bit as great as any writer's need to revise.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that point up. I stalk David Sedaris. Every time he comes into town, I watch him again, and he was saying something similar, that each sentence he writes has probably been written no less than 48 times. There is no sentence by accident. You know, it's it sounds so fluid, and it's heavily, heavily, heavily revised every time. And he said, and every time that I perform it and I get the feedback from the audience, I go home and rewrite it again because I, you know, there's nothing like immediate audience feedback, I guess, to look at their faces and see what they're thinking.
Right,
of you.
Right. And David Sedaris is doing two different things. I would say Jerry Seinfeld is doing one thing really well. But David Sedaris is doing two things because his work is really funny, and he's really funny. But his work is deceptively deep and profound at the same time. So he has a truly fine balance going there. So the story under the surface of all of his pieces, it seems to me, is about some kind of sorrow. Mm-hmm. And yet, you feel delighted to hear him talk about it. And the impact of it is muffled slightly by the fact that it's funny, but I think that the impact is also in some way amplified by the fact that it makes you laugh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sadness and laughter are two sides of the same coin. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Joanne Beard. The books are The Boys of My Youth and In Zanesville. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. So I've known you've been coming on for the last month, and I've been telling everybody that I know and soliciting their desires. And universally, everyone has asked if we could sort of dissect the fourth state of matter. I know you might be tired of talking about the fourth state of matter, but everyone has wanted to kind of dive into that essay. I don't know if you mind doing that a little bit.
Well, I'll tell you, I do mind a little bit. It's not that I can't talk about it or, you know, have some aversion to that particular essay. How do I say this? I feel funny talking about it. I don't feel right talking about it. And that isn't to say that I won't, but I would just I would just put that out there to you, that I have mixed feelings about that piece, and so therefore I feel a little funny talking about it.
Okay.
But fire away.
That's okay. Well, it's more a craft dissection of an essay, and so we really can do anyone. I mean, it really doesn't matter which one, and maybe we could choose one that you struggled with the most, that took you the most time. But what I really want to talk about is how you took an original kernel of an idea, and I know that you revise on a sentence-by-sentence basis, and that once the essay is done, you don't go back and heavily revise. So I kind of want to dig into that idea and how that works. So I don't know if there's an essay that works best, you know, to do that with.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's just how I write, so all of my writing is like that. I mean, we could talk about that in terms of essays. We could talk about that in terms of the novel, mm-hmm. Or short stories. I generally, in my writing, go forward and not backwards. And by generally, I mean always.
And so when you took, like, if you took, just flipping through the book now, if you took, like, Bonanza, did you know before that essay, before you ever sat down at your computer, did you know that that essay was going to be about sort of the sorrow and melancholy of being trapped in your grandparents' house? Or did that reveal itself to you through the sentence-by-sentence construction? Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely it revealed itself. When I wrote Bonanza, I wrote all the essays in that book many, many years ago. But when I wrote Bonanza, I lived in Iowa City. So I'm going to say that was, you know, 1991 or something like that, 92. And I was just doing a writing exercise with a friend of mine. And she lived across town from me. And it was evening, and we were both alone in our houses. And we decided that we were going to write together, even though we weren't sitting together. And we both felt like writing. And so we assigned ourselves a topic. Hmm. And then we wrote. We hung up the phone. We wrote for 30 minutes on that topic, just really fast writing, like put your hands on the keys and write whatever comes to your mind. And then in 30 minutes, we convened on the phone again, and then we read each other our pieces. And that's when I wrote Bonanza. And the assignment that we gave each other was to write about an experience in a childhood house. And so when I hung up the phone and sat down to write, that was the childhood house that came to mind, first of all, was my grandmother's house. And I had a lot of experience in that house, so all I had to do was draw on my memory of what it felt like to be there. And while I was describing the house, I think I remembered a particular night that I went there to spend the night, and my parents had to come pick me up because for some reason I was completely overcome with a kind of desperate melancholy that I felt occasionally as a child and still feel occasionally as an adult. So I just wrote that as the final scene in it.
Do you have other tricks that you use to make yourself sit down and write? I've heard before that you kind of call yourself a reluctant writer, that it's wonderful to have written, but it's hard to write. And I was wondering if you have kind of advice for how to make yourself sit down and do this work.
I don't know. You know, I enlist other people in it because it helps me to do that, because I will frequently disappoint myself in any variety of ways, but it's really hard for me to disappoint another person. I get kind of panicky about that. Mm. So I will make writing dates with friends, and just the same friend that I wrote Bonanza with, I will write with her frequently. I mean, we still live across the country. Now we live across the country from each other, but we still continue to do our fast writing together. And every year we go on vacation together for 2 weeks, a writing vacation, where we sit frequently at the same table and do our writing together. And there's something about having another person there to witness what you're doing that suddenly, I don't know, makes you feel like focusing your attention on your work instead of jumping up and down and wandering around and looking out windows and all the stuff that I do when I'm at home. Frequently when I'm at home and I have what I tell myself is a writing day, I never once sit down in the chair, and I won't allow myself to really do anything else. Like I won't say, okay, well, forget it. I'm going to the grocery store and I'm going to blah, blah. Instead, I roam around my house like a ghost, you know, clanking the chains all day until I can release myself from it. And then I go, well, that was my writing day. Don't ask me why I can't sit down and just do it, because it would be easier and much more pleasurable, no matter how bad it is, than clanking around like a ghost. But I can't, and it's my entire writing life has been like this.
I do think there's something to physical motion jarring out something. I mean, every writer I know seems to also be a runner or a walker or a, you know, they all say that most of their productive time is spent out on the hiking trails rather than sitting behind their computer. That's where their ideas come from. So I think sitting behind a computer screen with a cursor blinking at you is not necessarily a very productive way to get work done. I mean, it doesn't jog memories, you know, it's just paralyzing.
The interesting thing, though, is that if you don't sit down, it for sure doesn't get done. And that's kind of what I try to tell myself. Like, you just have to sit there. You just have to sit there. If you can make yourself sit there, something will happen, probably. But if you can't make yourself sit there, then nothing will happen for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of your amazing strengths, and I think this is just innate, but I don't know if you can teach to it, is your eye for detail and the specificity in which you notice things. Even when you're just talking now, the specificity in which you and the detail and the memories are so vivid. And I don't know if that's something that you can train a writer to do, to notice minute details, and then to pick out which of those details are going to serve the story and which are just, you know, separating the way from the chaff, or whatever that analogy is. But is there a way that you can kind of make yourself sit down and have vivid memories like that?
Well, for me, it's the best part of writing. The best part of writing is being able to describe things. And so I guess maybe I've trained myself to do that a little bit, just trained myself through the routine of it. But it's also what makes writing interesting, or it's what makes reading interesting for me, is the small, surprising visual details that reveal a world, as opposed to the writer going in and telling the story. I like much better to reveal the story. And one of the best ways to reveal it is through physical details that people will recognize.
And I just lost my train of thought. I had two things that I was going to say, and then I just lost both of them. Does that ever happen to you?
Well, yeah, all the time. I hate to say it. But I'll just continue for a second by saying that I was trained, or half-trained, or somebody attempted to train me as a painter. And I think that my first instinct was my connection to the visual world was such that I thought that I needed to paint or draw or make prints or something like that. And that didn't really work out for me very well. But when I found writing, I found a way to kind of revel in those visual details in the world that didn't involve having to mix paint and learn how to render things correctly or incorrectly, whatever the vogue was. And writing just felt like an easier way of painting the world than using a brush.
Hmm. I like that. Yeah, and I think the important thing for, especially for new writers and maybe new painters as we're on that analogy, is that, you know, an anecdote or a story or a memory or, you know, a very literal interpretation of a vase, if you're painting it, is not the art. It's not the literature. It's, you know, it's the job of the artist to make it something else, something deeper, to reveal some deeper truth. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of new writers as they're, you know, just especially essayists or memoirists, as they're just rendering a story. They're not digging deep enough to get to the essential universal truth of the story. They're just staying on that surface. And I don't know how you train a writer. Maybe it's just through time and experience to know that they, you know, whatever story they're telling needs to hit on deeper universal truths.
Right. It's the thing as a teacher that you have to keep going back to, because nobody really wants to read about untransformed suffering. It's not, it's something that you put in your diary if you want to for your own benefit, but you don't share it with other people. What you share with other people is transformed suffering. And the way you transform suffering is through what you were talking about before, creating some kind of deeper meaning from your story or from the story. And I think that the way that works best for me is to try to find metaphorical meaning in what you're writing about. And the way I find metaphorical meaning in what I'm reading and also in what I'm writing is through those physical details.
Hmm. So when you sit down to revise on a sentence by sentence level, it is through those details you believe that the story is revealing itself to you, that the essential universal truth is revealing itself to you?
Yeah. Yeah, if it succeeds in doing that. I mean, I guess if it doesn't, nobody's ever going to see it.
Yeah.
But yes, that's the way. And I don't think it's exactly precise to say that I revise sentence by sentence. I think it's fair to say I write sentence by sentence, and I write only going forward and not going backward. And that means that sometimes there's a long time between sentences for me while I'm trying to figure out how to take what I've done so far and move it forward in a coherent way.
And does that yield a lot of surprises to you as writer? Or is it like an inevitable surprise? Or is it, oh, I kind of knew what this was going to be all along?
I think neither of those things. Like, there's never any surprise to it. And there should never be any surprise to it. Everything that happens in an essay, and in a way, everything that happens in a story, should feel completely inevitable.
Hmm.
Because there should be only one way the story could turn out. And that's not to say that there aren't surprises in essays. If we want to talk for a second about the fourth state of matter, that essay has a complete surprise in it. So maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but in a way that also is inevitable, because that's the way I experienced that event when it happened.
Right.
As a complete surprise. So I also experienced it as a complete surprise when I wrote the essay, which was not intended to be about that. So there has to be a sense of inevitability about it. But that doesn't mean that while the reader is reading it, they know that that is going to happen. It just means that when it does happen, the reader goes, oh, yes, this makes psychological sense.
Can I ask what that essay was going to be about before it was about what it was about?
Dogs. I was going to write an essay called The History of Dogs. And so when I sat down to write it, it was going to be the history of dogs in my life, not the history of dogs, but it was going to be called The History of Dogs. And so, which I still think I would like to write that essay someday, because now I've had even more dogs than I had back then. But, yeah, so, you know, I had one dog who was above all other dogs, and I say that after having had a lot of really unbelievably great dogs in my life, but she was the one who everybody knew was a great dog and was a dog sort of outside the framework of typical dog. And so when she got sick and died, it was really painful, not just for me, but for a lot of people who had known her for, you know, the 15 years of her life and loved her. So when I sat down to write The History of Dogs, she was the first dog that I wanted to write about. And, of course, her death and her illness was the first thing that came to me because it was the most recent experience I'd had with her. And the last experience I'd had with her. So I began with her being sick and ailing. And, of course, that happened in my house in Iowa City when I was working in the physics department at the University of Iowa for a group of men who were my friends that I had worked with for, you know, 5 years at that point. And so they naturally became part of the story because my life at that time was very circumscribed. I went to work and I saw my friends at work and I came home to an empty house because I was divorced or getting divorced. And so in writing about the dog, I began writing about the life. And in writing about the life, suddenly as I followed the story down the inevitable trail, you know, events precluded me really writing something called The History of Dogs. I had to change the name of it, and I, at some point, had to change the focus of it while I was writing. But I didn't go back and change the beginning of it. I just followed the story as it led me down this path.
You're certainly welcome to opt out of this question, but I'm wondering if, and not necessarily even for this essay, but either for the novel or for any of the essays you've written, if having it out in the world is a different, you know, it's one thing to have it intimately on your computer where it's just you and the story, and then there's the other experience of having a novel or an essay out into the world to be digested by the world at large. And that is a very different experience. And I wonder if that experience of having it out in the world has changed your feeling about that essay, if that is one of the things that makes you uncomfortable about it now.
No, I don't think so. I mean, honestly, this, and I don't mean this the way it sounds, but I don't care if things are out in the world. It's like my process of writing is partially like doing a kind of self-surgery. It's a way of processing my life as well as writing. And so if I've done that to my own satisfaction, I don't really care how it appeals or doesn't appeal to another person. And I will say that I read everything to my friend in Iowa, and she reads all her work to me. And I do care what she thinks while I'm reading it to her because, I don't know, somehow I've built that into my process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, no, I don't care. This is my work, and it's what I have to do in order to not just process my life, but make art in the way that I feel compelled to make art, or to sit around in my house not making art. And so what the world thinks of my work or how they experience it really doesn't affect me, and it doesn't feel in any way like it's probably any of my business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's such a healthy perspective. I think that's... we were just talking about that last night. The publication is... Go ahead.
I don't know if it's a healthy perspective or not, but it's how I've always been. And I can tell you that when I was a painter, I was not like that. But when I found writing, there was a shift for me. And I thought, oh, this is my thing, and this is for me. And I always have been a big proponent of my own work, for what it's worth. And I know how that sounds. It's embarrassing to say it out loud. And I'm from the Midwest, and we don't say things like that. But I'm going to say it because it's honest. Mm-hmm. I actually am a fan of my work, and not all of my work, but the work that I put out there in the world, I put it out there because I think that it has merit, or it would never see the light of day. So it's good enough. And it doesn't mean that my old work, when I look back on it, I don't sometimes go, oh, I would do that differently now. But it does mean that I look at that old work and I think that was absolutely the best I could do at that point in my life. And I read a lot. And I wouldn't put something out there that I didn't think was good enough to be out in the world. Does that make me sound... like I have an enormous ego?
No.
Well, you have to say no, but
do you think if a man has
no,
but I, you know, the thing that strikes me about what you just said is I don't think a man would say that. And I think that for a woman to have to be an apologist about being proud of her own work is very interesting. And I uniquely,
right.
Uniquely feminine, or uniquely an experience only a woman would say. I just don't think I'd invite Jonathan Franzen on this show and hear him say that. I know he wouldn't,
yeah,
because I've heard him say just the opposite.
Yeah. Well, he might say just the opposite, you know, because when you're on a radio show, you get a little panicky and self-protective, et cetera. But Jonathan Franzen is, I'm a huge fan of his essay writing. I like his novels too, but I, you know, I'm always looking for good essay writers. And that guy is a soul searcher. He really, really is. And he is willing to present himself on the page as a kind of foil maybe for something. But he's willing to present himself with all of his, insecurities and the same warts that we all have. But I do take your point about it being a very female thing, and I think it is a very female thing to say, does that make me sound like an egomaniac or like I have a big ego? Because I actually don't have a big ego in terms of, I mean, the people listening to this don't know me, right? So I will just say to all of you, I don't have a big ego. I have a barely healthy ego where my regular day-to-day life is concerned, but I have somehow been granted confidence where my writing is concerned, and thank God for it, because I needed it, because for some reason I just one day went, I'm going to write, and I'm a good writer. And by the way, I said that long before I had ever done enough writing to know whether I was good or not good. But that is like an armor I wear. And I had to force my way into being published. And I did that because I thought, yeah, they're crazy if they don't publish my work. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what? If you're forceful enough and if you work hard enough on your writing, actually you can convince people, because a lot of things get published that aren't that good.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I mean, if you aren't a proponent of your own writing, it's no one else is going to be. I mean, it is a job that requires, I think, more tenacity than talent. You know, it requires both.
But, I agree.
But, yeah, I mean, agree. If you're not tenacious, and, it's not going to happen.
Right. And ideally, I'm speaking to the women out there, ideally you have a combination of both. You have the tenacity to push your work forward, but you also have the tenacity to take your talent and your ability and hone it.
Yes.
Which sometimes is harder than walking up to, you know, a literary journal editor at a cocktail party and saying, you should publish my work.
Yes. Yes.
You said, which I have done before, you know.
Yeah. You almost have to, yeah.
Well, it takes them by surprise, and they go, oh, who are you? And I go, I'm a nobody, but I'm a really good writer, and you should publish my work. And what happens, I discovered in that moment, is that, first of all, the people standing around you walk away in disgust because they thought that you were sort of shy and retiring, and when they discover that you're not, they're freaked out and find you distasteful for a moment until you explain yourself later. But the editor says, oh, well, okay, send me something. Mm-hmm. Out of surprise and out of uncomfortable, I have to get away from this personness.
Hmm. And I, you know, I'm just left wondering the gender experience of a man saying the same thing. I just, you have my mind spinning now, which is a good thing, But I do think it is much easier for men to self-advocate than it is for women to self-advocate and to turn it back on themselves and say everybody walked away in disgust or whatever they thought. I just don't think it's as difficult for men to do that for whatever reason and to self-reflect, you know, and to not feel insecure about it in the aftermath, I think is also, it's just an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
You said a while back that you felt like you were a better writer when you were younger because you felt like you were a high wire walker and you never looked down, and now all you do is look down. Does that accurately represent how you still feel? Do you still feel like...
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't remember saying that, but it sounds good, and it actually sounds true. I hope I did say it. But I think that I would revise it now to say, I don't think that I was a better writer then. I think I'm actually a better writer now, just because the more you write, you know, the better you get. It's like anything. But I think that the writing came easier to me right at the beginning. And part of that was because I was just reveling in it. I was reveling in how much fun it was just to sit and describe the world around me and to tell these stories in a way that would maybe allow somebody to see them as well as read them.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved more quickly, and when you have more pages, you somehow feel, I don't know, like you're accomplishing something. And now, it was so funny at the beginning of the hour when you were saying, you know, usually people come on because they have a new book to promote. I never have a new book to promote. I'm sure I'll never write another book again because it's just too hard for me. And ultimately not as satisfying as writing, you know, short pieces is to me. But the other thing I was going to say is that when I first started writing, I joined a writing program, you know, at a university. And it never occurred to me, being from the Midwest and doing what people told me all the time. I mean, I was working as a secretary. My whole life up until that time had been about doing what I was told. If a teacher said, "You have an essay due next Tuesday," I went home and wrote an essay. It never occurred to me not to do that. And now it constantly occurs to me not to do that.
Deadlines are a writer's best friend. However you can trick yourself, they really are.
I know. And, you know, for a while that worked for me. But nobody's imposing deadlines on me. And the ones that I impose on myself, I just learned at some point that, you know, they just had no teeth in them. So that doesn't really work for me either.
Yeah. Do you believe in the notion of talent, or do you think, having taught now for a long time at Sarah Lawrence, I know there are talented writers out there, and some people, you know, start the race a little bit ahead of others. But I just remember, as being a young writer, just wanting somebody to tell me, either have it or you should go to dental school. And, I think a lot of writers are searching for the answer, do I have it? And I'm wondering if that's even an interesting question to ask, or if, you know, the mere desire to do it and the ability to sit down and train yourself and read and put in the time at task is enough.
Well, it's a hard question. And I don't think that I would use the word talent. I think I would use the word vision. And there's all kinds of writing, right? Like, so you might have the talent to write a piece for a newspaper, or even a piece for a magazine like The New Yorker, which The New Yorker frequently has wonderful nonfiction pieces, but they're extremely formulaic. You would know when you saw them anywhere that they came out of The New Yorker. So you can be talented and write for a newspaper or a magazine or some other place. But in order to create art, to make an essay, a story, a book that actually reaches that deeper level and begins to work on a metaphorical level the way literature works, I think you have to have vision. And so, do I think people can train themselves? Absolutely, I do. Absolutely. I think by reading carefully, by learning what works for other writers, how they've managed to shape their story and infuse it with something that connects it to universal meaning, I think if you see that enough, if you analyze enough, if you pull things apart that you love, and figure out how that writer did what they did, you can help yourself as a writer to reach that deep place inside and put your vision forth in the world. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what we were talking about before. Like, you could, like an art student could ask the same question, do I have talent? Well, they can train themselves to draw and to paint in a way that is unique, that renders the world recognizable to people who look at it, but that's not art, that's illustration. And to take the next step, to make their work have meaning on a conceptual level as well as a visual level, they have to have vision. And they have to train themselves to recognize it in other people's work so that they can recognize it in their own and then feed it and nurture it and practice it.
I love that. Who do you recommend people read? Who do you have people that you're recommending reading right now?
What can I say? I can never remember what I've read that I've loved. But I'll tell you something that I've read recently that I thought was extraordinary was Richard Powers' novel called The Overstory.
Oh, uh-huh.
The that works on so many different levels. And not only is it a great novel to read about humans, but it's a great novel to read about the world. It ends up educating you in a way on issues having to do with the organic world around us and also on human behavior. And not only that, but it's sort of a romp. Like, you start it and you never want to leave that book behind until you're all the way done with it.
I love that. Well, we've covered a lot. I have like 800 more questions, but we covered a lot. Is there anything that we should have absolutely said that we didn't say as we're drawing down on our time?
I don't think so. I have to say, if we're drawing down on our time, that I'm really grateful to you for having invited me to do this, because it's been really interesting for me to think about these things. And I appreciate everybody who's struggled through listening to it, because I'm talking on a cell phone and my voice might not be as clear as you might want it, but thank you so much for this.
Thank you for this. This was such a rich hour, and I knew I was going to get a ton, and I got even more. So this was really, really a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck to all you writers out there.
They need it.
I know. We all do.
We all do, right. Joanne Beard, thank you so much for the hour.
Take care. Thanks.
You too. That was Joanne Beard. The book, if you haven't read it, The Boys of My Youth, it's been out for, 20 years. You've just got to pick it up. In Zanesville is, we didn't even get to talk about it. In Zanesville is her kind of young adult. It's, it's for everybody, but kind of young adult novel. Also wonderful. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, but stay tuned for more awesome music and programming coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be back with you next Wednesday morning. Take care.